You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right. Excuse me. Time for us to do Skype, which means Skype works a little different than everything else we do. So when you use Skype,
and lipstick red, she didn't sign,
you have to kind of clear the audio.
Yeah, hi, Josh speaking.
Good morning, Newsham, McNamara. Welcome to All Marine Radio on a Monday morning.
Hi there. Morning.
So, where you be right now? What are you doing?
Actually, instead of the usual, I'm in Taipei in Taiwan.
So that means it's what time?
Just about midnight.
Ah, it's actually civil. I like that. It's better.
Yeah, not too bad, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Taipei. What is it like? Have you never been there?
It's like China, but if China was full of nice people. I'm not being funny. You'd never think it was mainlander. They don't seem like mainland Chinese. I mean, they're generally Taiwanese are very friendly, sort of cheerful people. Taipei itself is a modern city. It reminds you a little bit of Seoul if you've been in Asia for a while. It gets newer and newer every time you come. And now it's just like a modern city, though if you, like anywhere, most of Asia, if you just turn a corner and get off the main street,
right,
you do see a lot of 50s or 40s and 50s and 60s era buildings and even older. So there are a lot of remnants of the Japanese colonial era. If you've been to Taiwan, Taipei, and to mainland China, it's really striking just how different the attitude is. And once again, Taiwan is sort of empirical evidence that Chinese people can handle democracy and individual liberty and that sort of thing, all the things which the Chinese Communist Party claims they cannot. So it's an interesting place, but it does sort of economically, it looks prosperous, but it's had trouble for a long time now. I think partly owing to its excessive dependence on the mainland, but also the mainland or the PRC's efforts to isolate and ostracize Taiwan from the international community,
mm-hmm,
have had a lot of effect.
I'm curious. When you talk, you mentioned Japanese colonialism. So two questions for you about the history of Taiwan and one more history and one current events. In the scale of hate in the Pacific Rim, for Japan specifically, can you rank nations? Is Japan, Korea number one, Japan, China number one? Japan occupied the Philippines. They occupied certainly Taiwan, Taipei. Can you give us a sense in terms of who's put that in the past and looks to the future and who doesn't do so well with it?
That's a good question. And oddly enough, it seldom gets asked and answered, as you would think. I think you always hear, often hear from really the commentariat or the chattering class in Washington and elsewhere is that, well, everybody in Asia hates Japan.
Right.
Well, that's just not true. If you were to go down that list that you've described, Korea would be at the top of it. And it'd probably be ahead of the Chinese, actually, and the Chinese would be second. But a lot of this is cynically manipulated by the Chinese Communist Party. And actually, in parts of China, the Japanese are not that disliked. In Manchuria, for instance, they were actually more popular than one would think. But there is a lot of genuine resentment of the Japanese in China. But a lot of it is egged on by the Communist Party. And they didn't really start it until probably only, I don't know, 25 years ago when they needed to do it for political reasons. And if you move beyond the Taiwan, the Japanese colonial era experience was actually pretty well regarded, certainly preferable to when the mainland Chinese, when Chiang Kai-shek's people came and took over. The Japanese were actually pretty popular, and still are. I've heard different reasons for that. One of them is said to be that the Japanese Navy had a lead in running Taiwan, while the Japanese Army had a lead in running Korea. I don't know if that's true or not. But the Taiwanese actually have good feelings towards Japan, and is speaking only a little bit hyperbole, that they wouldn't mind being part of Japan. If you go down Vietnam, there's good feelings towards the Japanese, who are partly seen as responsible, have helped with Vietnamese independence. The Indonesians also are well regard the Japanese for similar reasons, for seen as helping getting rid of the Dutch. They do overlook those few hundred thousand largely Indonesian laborers who were basically murdered on the Burma-Siam Railway. But that's, I guess, neither here nor there for the Indonesians. The Singaporeans, who suffered mightily, have managed to put let bygones be bygones and do very well with the Japanese and towards the Japanese. There isn't much resentment there. The Australians have done pretty well, too, in putting the past behind them. And India, all billion plus of them, like Japan, actually, they, once again, the Indians give the Japanese some credit for helping to get rid of Western imperialism in Asia. So, and the Philippines as well, it's mixed, but pretty good feelings towards the Japanese. And the Japanese were really cruel in the Philippines in World War II, but there has always been a slice of Filipino society, particularly the ruling class, that did a very good job of being like Asian quislings in terms of cozying up to the Japanese, and they've got that characteristic. So if you go down the list and look at the map, that actually, except for Korea and China, the Japanese are actually pretty well regarded, and in some cases very well regarded, and that includes both the colonial experience and also World War II experience. So I forgot Malaysia.
Right.
The Malaysian Chinese weren't too happy with the Japanese, and for good reason, because they were barbaric. But towards the Malays and the resident Indians, the Japanese were actually pretty well behaved, and the Japanese are not at all looked at askance. I actually had a friend whose father was the police chief in Penang during the Japanese occupation, or assistant police chief. And I asked, he's a Malay, and I asked him, well, you know, what it was like, and I thought he was going to tell me these stories about the horrible Japanese. And he said, oh, it was, you know, pretty good. Some words to that effect, which was sort of a surprise. And then the more I learned about it, the more I realized that like a lot of things, the experiences are complex, and you can almost find any opinion you want in any society. But by and large, the Japanese are not at all unpopular in most of Asia.
Is it something that's whipped up for expedience politically?
I think only in China and to a degree in Korea, but in Korea, I think, as we mentioned before on this show, that there is an Irish aspect to it where it's irrational. You know, it's based on some real wrong, you know, misbehavior and cruelty on the part of the Japanese, but it's gone on probably longer than is natural. But in China, once again, the Japanese were barbaric and depraved and some cases, but the Chinese Communist Party, as I said, has whipped it up. And if you go to mainland China, you know, it's like every night on the news, or excuse me, on the TV, there's these movies, those are World War II movies that depict the Japanese as devils, and it's like like a Lone Ranger cartoon almost, and it's formulaic. And it's just amazing that it's almost every night, and it is this contrived. But you show enough of that, and people do tend to sort of get a certain image of the Japanese. But even you notice when the Chinese Communist Party turns on these sort of rent-a-mobs to protest in China against, say, Japanese stores and outside the Japanese embassy.
Right.
And they are rent-a-mobs that they don't, it's not like, you know, everybody comes out, which is something to keep in mind. And, you know, Japanese restaurants are popular and Japanese cars are popular too. In China. So it's, once again, it is contrived to a degree. But that, and, you know, I don't want to excuse anything Japan did during World War II because their treatment of helpless civilians and non-combatants and really helpless combatants as well was, it was comparable to what the Mongols did in Krakow in the 13th century. Maybe not quite, but it wasn't much better. But that said, it was a long time ago. And even at the time, there was a lot of support for Japan, who were seen as getting rid of Western colonialism. And that movement, the anti-colonialism, the anti-colonial movement, that had been going on since the late 1880s, the Japanese were seen as the leaders of that in Asia, and gave immense support to both Sun Yat-sen, to the Chinese revolutionaries, and revolutionaries throughout Asia. And it was a Japanese government policy, in fact, to push that. Of course, replacing it with Japanese colonialism. That's how things work.
As Paul Harvey said, the rest of the story. Or as he used to say. What? Next question. And talk about coming full circle. USS Carl Vinson pulled into port in Da Nang today. For the first Vietnamese port visit by United States, by one of our, you know, our symbols of American might, and that is the American aircraft carrier. The significance of that visit is what?
Well, you know, it is significant. You know, it's not the end of the game. You know, I compare it to like hitting a home run in about the third inning or the second inning of a baseball game. You know, it's nice, but you've still got, you know, some innings to go. You know, once again, it does show that the U.S., there's a couple few things at least that are significant. One, it shows the U.S. is popular and that there are countries that wish the Americans would be interested and would stick around in Asia and stand up to China. And Vietnam is one of those. You know, plus this, you know, I guess the Vietnam War ended in 1975-ish. And, you know, it does, so it is, but our relationship with Vietnam has improved starting some years back. But this is not, but sending an aircraft carrier somewhere with everything this involves is psychologically significant. It's politically significant as well, although one doesn't want to toss the Vietnamese right into our camp at the moment, because they do hedge their bets. But nonetheless, if there's anyone in Asia, particularly with a border adjoining China, who is willing to stand up for themselves, it is the Vietnamese in general. This is not to describe the sort of the Communist Party that rule, the clique that rules Vietnam, as being all that great. But in general, the Vietnamese in general, I think, are the people who will stand up and they don't like the Chinese when it comes down to it. They do realize they have to make accommodations and there's limits to what they can do. But inviting an American aircraft carrier has a lot of symbolism to it. And also, even with other countries in the region, there's some that have been hopelessly bought off, but there's others who are on the fence waiting to see what America will or will not do. So the Carl Vinson showing up is a good thing. But a lot, of course, it'll be there however long, maybe say a week, that the other 51 weeks of the year, what you do in Asia and Southeast Asia matter probably as much. But it did take, it has taken a while for the Americans to actually get to this point, which I think is longer than it should have, because the Vietnamese have been putting out feelers for a long time, wanting the Americans to do more. I think I'd say it's probably taken, goodness, almost 10 years to get here. And I think if you had let majors and captains actually run our policies, and they, Carl Vinson would probably have been there 5 years ago.
I don't know. This our conversations always frustrate me. All right. Interesting, because again, I the map that shows the nine dash line I have here in my office, and whenever I see it, I almost chuckle. And it reminds me of, you know, the con game that Vladimir Putin, you know, whose economy is smaller than Canada. Putin runs a con game on the rest of the world, this Russian menace that is not so much. And he stands and he bloviates, and he's a skilled politician. And he's very, very well practiced in the art. And he preys on people's uncertainty and his own image. And so, and then you see the Chinese do it. And it just, it's mind-boggling, in my opinion, that we're going to lay down this nine-dash line, and what's anybody going to say about it? And then I got an email for you here. Mac, I'm curious, the rhetoric from the Philippines has toned down noticeably in the course of the last 6 months. What's Grant's read on that? The Philippines certainly have put us on notice that they are more than willing to dance with the Chinese. But unlike, it seems like, his first year in office, Mr. Duterte is noticeably quieter these days. Is there anything to that? Yeah, Grant, he is kind of quiet these days. What's going on down there?
That's a good question. My take, and once again, it's just my take, and right. There's guys who really know the Philippines would be the ones who really be worth listening to. But I think I get to use the word Quisling twice in about 5 minutes. I think Duterte is as much of a Quisling as he's ever been. What'd you call it? A traitor, basically. use the proper word. But I have a feeling that after about a year, like a lot of people there, their act kind of wears thin a little bit. You know, they come into office with a lot of expectations. They're a breath of fresh air who are going to bring, you know, peace and stability to the country and make everybody rich. And it never quite works out that way. And I think you're starting to see the opposition to him sort of getting their feet a little bit, getting a little bit of courage, and starting to push back. And I think he's got some room for doubt now. He's got some concerns and some worries about just how solid his footing is. And I think that is manifesting itself somewhat in his, or in that, what do you call it, relative change in the from about a year ago, when it was just nonstop insults of America and bold talk and all this. But I think the opposition, once again, you kind of, you take some blows for a while and then it stops and you catch your breath. I think the opposition to him, I think, is coming back a bit. Plus the Chinese have just, as they want to do, or have overdone it, you know, with, these demands that they're going to, start surveying territory out to the east, right to the east of the Philippines, and they've been just even for the Chinese, they've been overbearing, and even the Filipinos kind of have to take notice of that. But there is a part of the Philippine ruling class which really doesn't like what the Chinese are doing and does not like what Duterte is doing to appease and then some the Chinese, and so I think that's probably manifesting itself. I think there's still a ways to go, though, before Duterte completely wears out his welcome. And I wonder, though, I just don't know, if he will be gone, if when he leaves, that he sort of been able to change things so much that the Chinese have an advantage, an easy advantage over the Philippines that can't be recovered from. I just don't know how that's going to work out. Say economic dependence, once again, it could be heavier, tighter. Plus, if you do get a Chinese military presence closer to the Philippines that isn't even challenged, that could sort of put the Philippines in something of a stranglehold that they weren't in before Duterte came, and that the Obama administration helped put them in. So we'll see how that goes. But once again, I always like to think of the Donald Rumsfeld effect, where one recalls he was on the cover of like People magazine or something like that. It's like the coolest guy alive. And then a year later, I mean, nobody even wanted to be seen in the same room with him. So these things have a way the pendulum has a way of shifting back, but we'll see.
Certainly, the toned down rhetoric and the much longer periods of silence would hopefully forebode a more moderate tone out of Manila. Yes,
I would hope so. And it once again, like if you with him, you know, you just I think the U.S. has done a pretty good job of not responding to him,
right,
the way they. One might be inclined to, and kind of just let it play out. Because, you know, fortunately, we do have some, I guess, couple thousand years of human history and experience to see how guys like him turn out. And, you know, I say, so we've seen this sort of character before, and they do come and go. You know, unfortunately, it is the Philippines we're talking about here, so it's not as if Duterte's going to turn them loose on the rest of Asia. But so there's a limit to how much damage he can do. And I just crossed my mind as we're talking you notice that the U.S. still does military exercises with the Philippines. I believe Special Forces and some of the intelligence guys were very helpful with this problem down south in Marawi,
right,
with the Mohammedans,
right.
That supposedly Duterte was the guy who had an in to the Islamic extremists, was going to resolve it all, and that has proven to be wrong. And I think that's another thing which has kind of shaken him, that hasn't handled Mindanao any better than anyone else has, and probably worse in some respects. So that might account partly for his quietness. But once again, we'll see how this goes, and it is significant that the U.S. still does exercises. I think I read a nuclear submarine or a submarine showed up in Subic Bay just the other day. When you scratch the surface, we've still got some prospects there, and maybe with time it'll swing back.
All right. Up to before we head to Japan, up to Korea. During the Olympics, supposedly a visit was called off with Vice President Mike Pence. And then over the weekend, the president was tweeting that the Koreans have called and they want to talk. And so I guess we're waiting for other developments on that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, we'll see. You know, looking back 25 years of how things have played out, that I wouldn't be surprised if it isn't even a dance. It's like
right.
Two people kind of grunting at each other from, you know, from different rooms. That I think it may, you know, the South Koreans are going to go up, talk to them. They're doing it right now, talking to the North Koreans.
And that business going on like now, right? Yes?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So they're talking, and I suspect they'll come back, and there'll be these, sort of vague pronouncements about the North kind of North is willing to talk, but blah blah blah, and then it'll be the ball will be in America's court, and maybe America will say, yeah, we'll talk to them, but if they'll have to talk about denuclearization of the peninsula, and the North says, no, we'll never do that, and then the Americans say, okay. So in some ways, I think it's think that America is might be going through, if not, I wouldn't say quite going through the motions, but I don't think they are going to give up much at all just for the privilege of talking to the North Koreans. So I don't think this is going to lead to anything too substantial. You do have previous U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican, which have considered just the mere fact of being able to talk with the North Koreans to be a sign of progress, to be a good thing. So any accommodation just about was acceptable as long as they could get the North Koreans to the table. You know, sort of like a tar paper salesman who just thinks, if I can just talk to the
right.
talk to the prospect, I can get him to see my way of thinking. You know, how dumb can you be? And I don't think this administration thinks that at this point. So I see it as sort of a formality that the Americans are going through, and the North Koreans are trying to play them as they have successfully for a long time. But I don't think this administration is going to fall for that. No, I don't. I think they realize that just talking is not going to get anywhere unless the North makes the concessions. I don't think it's going to be the Americans that do, but America can at least say, well, we tried. You know, we know what we need to do, which is get rid of those nuclear weapons. And that's, we're glad to talk about that, but we're not going to compromise beyond that just for the privilege of sitting around a table with the North Koreans. That would be my guess. And, you know, there is always the possibility that there are some, quote, talks that take place. And I gather there have been behind-the-scenes communications. But I don't think this is going to amount to much. I would suspect we'll probably have to wait maybe a couple months to get a better sense of how the specifics play out. But I think we'll end up about where we were before the Olympics.
Okay. Here's another interesting question. Mac, ask Grant, what will we see before something legitimate happens? Will we see economic pain to the extent we haven't seen yet, Korea, and then in parentheses, North Korean type, blustering relative to shooting more missiles, and then the Chinese intercede in essentially four-party talks between the North Koreans, the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the U.S. What does Grant see the pathway to some legitimate negotiation, assuming that none of the efforts in the short term bear fruit and that the United States continues to tighten sanctions, as the president seems to be willing to do? What will happen when something ultimately does happen? So that's kind of an interesting. Look at your crystal ball, Grant. What would that look like?
Well, you know, I can only sort of speculate,
sure,
as anyone, but I would suspect that I could see it playing out with the Americans ratcheting up, particularly maritime interdiction of transport to and from North Korea. And I think they could do it pretty easily. I have a feeling they're thinking about it. And so you ratchet that up, and you doing it applies, it has a sort of a disproportionate effect because there isn't a whole lot of maritime transport to and from North Korea. So if you knock off a few ships, it's not like they've got thousands of others. But so that could actually have an effect. And I think we're going to see more along those lines. And the Japanese are showing themselves very adept at maritime surveillance. They've always been good at that, and they're just showing it with some sanctions busting, which they've uncovered recently and publicized, which is maybe the bigger thing.
Right.
So I can see that tighten sanctions on these overseas illegal and legal activities that the North Koreans do. I think that is going to continue. And I think it's going to get tighter and tighter. And once again, the maritime interdiction is going to be a change because that's never really been done. And I could see, but I think all of those things that unless you get China, I think that even turning up the heat on North Korea would not be enough.
Okay.
Because China can always make up the difference and is willing to, and Russia as well as willing has shown themselves willing to get involved also. So I think that once that you see a major Chinese bank sanctioned, I take your pick, but People's Bank of China would be my choice. I mean, when you see the Americans put sanctions on a major Chinese bank, then I think you will know that something is going to happen in terms of China using its pressure to bring North Korea to the table and somewhat willing to make some concessions. But until China feels pain, I don't think that that North Korea is going to make the sort of shift in their position that we want them to make. But so ultimately, it does go through China. And that's what I'm watching for, is when we actually do something that makes the Chinese worry. And that has not happened yet, unfortunately. But it's not as if it's not as if there are not people in the administration who don't realize this and know what needs done. It's just a question of them getting the chance to do it. When that happens, I'm not sure. But that's the thing for me, at least, to watch out for is China, to what we do to China. The North Korea stuff is really interesting, and I would do everything I possibly could. But unless China is brought, is forced to make a decision, either do business with North Korea or do business with the United States, until they're presented with that choice, that I don't think that anything is going to happen negotiations-wise, which leaves us in a position of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs continuing to develop, right, and reaching a point at which a U.S. president has that choice to make. Do I live with this and let America stay sort of susceptible to blackmail, or do I do something about it? And regardless of the president, they've got to make that choice. And I think my guess is that's probably where we're going to end up. And I don't know how a president will decide, but if we've ever had one that would consider taking a shot, we've probably got him now. And I think even a Democratic president, if it had been Mrs. Clinton, I think she too would have to make that decision. So I think we're we're sort of within sight of, I think, getting to that point. So I'm not too optimistic about negotiations working until I see China really being pressured.
Okay, so the path to some kind of serious negotiation, and it would certainly involve all four parties, yes?
Probably. I would like, it sort of complicates it if you have all four come. But I think that would be, it'd be wise of the Americans to hold out for that, and I think they will. Because you can't, if it looks like America's going to cut a deal one way or the other without the South Koreans being in it, that's not good for our relationship with the South Koreans. And also, we should be sort of demonstrating control over the negotiations, and it should be up to us to decide who we want to get involved, and the South Koreans are our allies, and they should be there. I've always thought the four, it should be us and the South Koreans at the table, not us cutting some deal with the North Koreans.
Right.
It just always seems unnatural to do it that way.
No,
Koreans are our allies.
Right, right. No, I mean, it seems ridiculous. Well, wait a minute, where are they? Where's the other half of the peninsula? They're not a part of this? Please. If it's going to be a lasting, if it's going to be an enduring agreement, the South Koreans better be part of it. And in my opinion, the Chinese, if they're not a part of it, then something's wrong there too, because they've got to underwrite this deal as well. And if they don't, then it's not worth it. In my opinion, it's not worth the paper it's written on. If the Chinese don't come, so we continue to see maritime interdiction. We'll continue to see increased sanctions. At some point, North Korea screams because of the pain. Still no movement. They continue to survive because of Chinese sponsorship. At some point, the Americans would or may consider at least in your crystal ball, sanctioning the Bank of China, and then that would get the Chinese attention, and ultimately they would say, look, we need to do business with the United States. Let's sit down and talk, because this is now becoming a problem for us. So that would be a path that you would see that would lead to legitimate negotiations relative to this involving all four parties.
And that's how I would go about it. Yeah. You know, something along those lines. Unfortunate. They had about a year to get around to this, and time's a wasting, but once again, better late than never, I suppose.
Right.
But yes, that would be my general approach to it if I was getting $6 an hour to handle the matter.
my guest is Grant Newsham, and he's joining us from Taipei this morning on a remarkably clear connection. Very nice. Another email. Mac, is the danger of North Korea's development of nuclear weapons the danger that they'll shoot one at us, or that they will proliferate the development of nuclear weapons to all these other shithole nations, and one of them may shoot one against another one of them? I'm specifically talking about Middle East and in Asia, Afghanistan, yada, yada, yada. Grant's thoughts on that. So what's the greater danger, Grant, that they'll shoot one at us, or the proliferation problem?
Well, I think it's actually the latter. I think the question's a good one, and it's of course, always, as the question notes, it's possible to have a couple things to worry about from somebody at the same time, and the proliferation one, I think, is the as big as the actual danger of them launching something in our direction. It's striking just how little administration attention has ever been paid to North Korea's overseas activities, and to include in particular the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Their support for the Syrian nuclear program was well known. They have very close ties with the Iranians, and for both missile and nuclear technology in both cases, and also chemical weapons or poison gas, for want of a better word, involvement here and there. And yet nobody ever talks about this. It's like administrations have been afraid to publicize this and expose what they are doing and who they're doing it with. For whatever fear, once again, I suppose that the North Koreans might not be willing someday to talk to us. It's been crazy. And because we have never really gone after this, you've got this, I think this is a very real risk that's been pointed out, of proliferation, of giving the technology or even actual working weapons to some of these nasty countries around the world. And even nasty groups also. And once again, it doesn't require to use this stuff, to employ it. You don't have to have intercontinental ballistic missiles. Just get it onto a ship and into a U.S. harbor, into the harbor of a U.S. ally, and blow it up. Take your pick. There's all sorts of ways to do mischief. So I see that as an immense concern. And once again, it's partly our fault that we have allowed it to continue. And once again, I would cite the North Korean-Iranian connections, which have been obvious to just about anyone for a long time, that we act as though there's nothing we can do about this. So that is a serious problem. Plus and then there is, of course, as the email noted, or suggested, once they get these weapons that people kind of know can work, you get this constant hectoring and threatening against us, which we don't like. It tires us out. But also the South Koreans have to deal with some, the real intimidation. And once again, people say, well, he's just talking. But when you've got a big, scary guy, in the trailer next door, who's, cocking his shotguns, and you can hear him doing it inside his trailer, and he's yelling out that he's going to come kill you all. At some point, the talk gets tiring, And that one is you have to do something about it, or else, and also it's not good for the U.S.-South Korea relationship to have the South getting bullied and the Americans really being seen as helpless to do anything about it. So I would not be too optimistic about how all this plays out. And the email certainly points out some of the main concerns, but the proliferation one, that has been ignored for at least 20 years, probably longer actually, by successive administrations, which is unfortunate.
So you would say that the proliferation issue is probably greater than the the actual launch issue.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think that's how I would characterize it. It's not that the other risk is or threat is nothing to worry about, but I think the proliferation one, just by its nature, it's harder. It takes place in the shadows. And it's harder to keep track of. But I think that is, for me, the bigger concern. Plus, you do find that the North Koreans, even if it's not like, boxing up a nuclear weapon and shipping it off to Iran or Syria or wherever, sometimes they can provide pieces of the puzzle which help these other groups advance their capabilities beyond what they otherwise would be. So that's part of the concern, and that is where I would, really, it would almost be enough based on that risk to do something about it, to have to stop it. Now, you wonder what an administration will do. It's a tough decision for a president, but at least it's definable. So it's not as if nobody knows what the risk is and what needs done or what the potential options are. So it's one that can't be avoided for that much longer, as I see it.
All right. The Japanese, I want to say last week or the week before, discussed placing land-based surface-to-ship missiles on Okinawa, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that, and then we hear all the saber rattling from the Okinawans about getting the bases off Okinawa. I don't know that we hear as much from mainland Japan. How do you coexist when you don't have your own military and somebody else foots the bill to defend you, especially, I kind of find these two issues linked. We're going to install, surface to ship missiles in Okinawa because we're afraid, based on what we've seen in the South China Sea, that that's coming to a theater in the East China Sea very soon, that you're going to see the Chinese develop, something out there and begin to physically lay claim to something they've heretofore argued about. Yet the Americans guarantee that. The Japanese certainly can't. How does all this coexist in Japan?
I think that you have to give the Japanese some credit for at least making an effort in certain quarters to defend themselves. It's not at all what it should be, and it's about as uncoordinated as it could possibly be, but they are trying. This notion of anti-ship missiles based on the main island of Okinawa, it didn't really attract much attention at all, because it's kind of, it's just seen as a logical extension of what the Japanese are already doing in the rest of the, it's called the Nansei Shoto, the Ryukyu Islands, that chain, that have had underway for a few years now, a plan to put GSDF detachments on Yonaguni, which is the closest one, the one at the bottom next to Taiwan, Miyakojima, as I recall, and Amami, which is up north of Okinawa. So these plans have been afoot. They've started. There's public support for them on those islands. And these will include anti-ship missiles. There'll be anti-aircraft. They haven't talked about that, but that'll be there. But they're described mostly as surveillance locations. But actual fact, they're part of a defensive scheme that has been thought out by the Japanese military, the Ground Self-Defense Force in particular, to kind of lock up the passages between the islands. And so putting the anti-ship missiles on Okinawa, you'd have thought there'd be a little more complaining from the Okinawan opposition, but it is funny, I didn't hear it, which tells you a lot. And if you look at these other islands where the GSDF, the Ground Self-Defense Force, is putting in the bases, that they're actually pretty welcome. And on one of them, it's not Miyakojima, very welcome, but even on Ishigaki, which is near Miyakojima, and it's been considered kind of a leftist sort of place, but it's always had a very conservative faction there, even to include the mayors. And these guys, and they really do fear China, and particularly the fishing cooperatives, have really been displaced from their traditional fishing areas by Chinese fishermen. And they would love the Japanese military to come down and let them go fish again. So there's a lot of support for this Japanese military presence. But in the Nansei Shoto, and I think even on the main island of Okinawa, once again, you didn't see any sort of outcry about this, which is significant. But it's just sort of seen as one more piece of the puzzle. But you'll notice when I've described this that I have only mentioned the Ground Self-Defense Force.
Right.
I haven't mentioned the Maritime Self-Defense Force or the Air Force. And there, you know, and there's a reason for that, is because as far as I know, the effort is pretty much being done in isolation, each service doing whatever it feels like doing. Does not appear to be coordinated in anywhere near the way it should be, and that's among the Japanese military, much less coordinated with the Americans, which is what it needs to be. I actually remember about 2009 being invited over to the Japanese headquarters in Tokyo with a couple other Americans, and the Japanese Army actually explained to us their plan for defending the Southwest Islands. And this was 2009. And this was like, it was almost like a drunken man awaking from a stupor and suddenly realized he's about to get strangled by a python, which is how the Japanese reaction struck us, because we were so used to one excuse after another for why Japan couldn't do anything, blah, blah, blah. And here they had put together a scheme for, once again, fortifying not in a Maginot line way, but putting a military presence with the ability to hurt people on the Nansei Shoto Islands, which was the first time I can recall the Japanese army, at least, doing something sort of aggressive or sort of potentially warlike in a good long while. I actually remember that experience very well. And this plan, so it's been almost 10 years now, it is afoot. It's taken longer than it might have, of course. We could have helped it along faster, but we didn't. That announcement that you saw in the paper about anti-ship missiles on Okinawa is just a logical extension. And there's a Japanese word, it's called atarimae, which means like, yeah, no kidding, sort of. And that's sort of, I think, the reaction to potentially putting anti-ship missiles on the main island of Okinawa is sort of atarimae, is, yeah, okay, it's about time. If they'd done it out of the blue, say, 5-10 years ago, that would have been a much bigger deal, is my take.
My guest is Grant Newsham. And so how do these all coexist, Grant? This looming Chinese menace, this desire to see the Americans leave Okinawa, the missiles, it sounds very complicated to get to mesh at some point, or do they worry about the fact that it meshes?
I don't think they worry. Like a lot of things, it depends on who you talk to. You know, so if you talk to, say, one of the people on Okinawa who are the professional opposition, They will, of course, you know, just their thing will be that, well, we just have to get rid of the Americans, get rid of the bases, blah, blah, blah. China is not a threat. And in some cases, they'll go cash their paychecks from the Chinese after saying that. Not in all cases, but some. And then again, you'll have other Japanese, even on Okinawa, who realize that China is a threat that needs to be defended against. So it's as complex a society as anywhere, where you have different viewpoints of things. But by and large, these contrasting ideas coexist, and I think the central government does. Basically, say most of the central government does realize it needs to do something to defend itself. But it has a Japan self-defense force. But it's once again, it takes place in this context of the Americans having been around forever to make up the difference, to really be the guarantor, and to do anything that Japan doesn't feel like doing, the Americans will do it. And that sense of just excessive dependency on the Americans really does shape Japanese thinking. So while they've got a military and some has some niche capabilities that are excellent, you know, it has some real serious shortcomings in terms of lack of joint capability, lack of money, really lack of a coherent unified defense strategy for Japan. And once again, I think a lot of this does track back to this excessive dependence on the United States, and neither side being able to figure out or being willing to take the first step to straighten this out. There've been some efforts in the past, but nothing consistent on the U.S. side to once again to straighten it out, and on the Japanese side, unless they're pushed. They're going to be quite happy with the Americans making up the difference, but a problem there is that if the Japanese somehow get the idea the Americans aren't doing what the Japanese want, that the Americans are then misbehaving. And it tends to, well, these kind of imbalanced relationships, whether between nations or between people, over time, that tends to create some friction and resentment as each side considers the other either not doing enough or the other side not being fair. And it's not a good thing to have that kind of imbalance. And we've still got it, and it'd be nice if we could take some steps to make it a more balanced relationship, even if not an equal one. And so I tend to look at what the Japanese, the Nansei Shoto, that Ryukyu defense plan, I actually look at it as something we could capitalize on, both sides could, if they wanted, and really make it a joint plan where the Americans and the Japanese get together and decide that we are going to defend the Southern Islands together and start exercising, patrolling together. On the water, below the water, and above the surface, and down in the Nansei Shoto to the left of Okinawa on the west side. That would be maybe the biggest thing the Americans and the Japanese could do, and I wish we would do it. It's pretty obvious. And like a lot of things, unless the captains and the majors are left to sort it out, it probably won't happen for a long time.
Final question. You wrote a piece entitled "Send in the Marines" about amphibious capabilities in the Western Pacific, in our Western Pacific. Tell everybody about it.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't write the headline. My headline would have been more like something Pat Buchanan or Al Sharpton would have written. What the piece is about is pointing out that after 50-plus years of the Marines doing exercises and training in the Western Pacific, we still have nobody with whom we can do a real-world short-notice joint operation or amphibious operation. Yes, if we have 6 months to plan something, we can put together a VIP landing that looks good, but we have not really created any useful amphibious allies. There is really no nice way to put this. This is not to I think our training scheme is excellent. I think it covers the region. It's very well thought out. But we haven't produced, you know, unless you've got You know, and it, keep in mind that every exercise we've ever done has said that it is going to promote capabilities and interoperability. Okay, well, half a century is a long time, so who is it that we can actually operate with in that real-world short-notice way? In short, in a little while, it will be the Australians, but that's because it's the Australians, and all we did was facilitate this a little. They would have done it on their own once they realized a few years back they needed an amphibious capability. So that was what I was pointing out, is that we have not produced. I use an analogy that we've become like the Harlem Globetrotters, who show up and put on a great show. And we might even let some people come out of the audience and we'll hold them up and they can drop the ball through the hoop. But we go away without having produced any better basketball players. So what I'm suggesting is that the Marine Corps writ large needs to do is to focus on two things. And one of those is building an environment in regional militaries, select ones, where amphibious forces are valued and allowed to develop and properly supported. And that requires us to sell the idea of amphibious capability. Additionally, if you're not there, if you're not on scene, that we come to town, the Globetrotters come to town, go away, and then nothing much changes over the next 51 weeks of the year. So my suggestion is, one, a systematic sales campaign by the Marines to create a sort of supporting environment for amphibious forces in regional militaries, because in all cases, the amphibious forces they are the unloved stepchild. Now, to bring this about, what I proposed is taking about a half dozen Marine officers, and these are the guys with the magic, that who can get into a place and influence, and put them into these half dozen priority countries with the mission of selling amphibious capability and making our partners better. And the exercises actually feed on this and actually support that effort. But that is what I propose. Just six officers, the right ones, and I use the expression the right captain is better than the wrong colonel. And that would be a useful addition to what the Marines have been doing, and I think it might give us better return on our investment. You'll note that that's effectively what we did in Japan, and that whole Japanese amphibious force is the result, I think, of the sort of a major at Marfor PAC vaporizing the opposition so that a Marine officer could be put full-time in Tokyo to influence. And going from something that was thought impossible in 2012 to really a rudimentary Japanese amphibious force shows what can be done. Additionally, once again, the Australians will tell you that they have been able to move along much faster by virtue of having Marines full-time in Australia. And third example is the South Koreans, where the South Korean Marines are probably farthest along of the Asian Marine Corps, and the Marines have had a full-time presence in Korea for a long, long while, and that has really shaped the sort of has made the ROC Marines come along faster. But it's that idea of just a half dozen Marines. But I've been told forcefully by senior Marine officers that the Marine Corps, despite having 20,000 active duty officers and a boatload of reserve officers, has not got six officers to spare for this sort of duty. So go figure. But that was what my story is. That was the piece. It's recognizing that Marines have a good training and exercise scheme, but they have not done a good job of selling amphibious capabilities nor having a permanent presence for when they're not in town to do the selling and to make people better. And, you know, I think we've all seen how there are these submarine officers and even senior NCOs who have this magic, and people want to be like them. And you find those and you put them in a few places and good things start to happen. So that's what I wrote. This is also why I never get invited anywhere except for this radio show.
The heretics. We're a fine group. And people don't like the truth. Right? And there's a million reasons not to do it, but...
Well, yeah, they don't listen to me.
Exactly. Why would we? All right, sir. And just somebody sent me an email that said, ask about the significance of the USS Carl Vinson in Vietnam. We spoke about that at the start of the hour, so you can pick that up on the podcast. Grant, always a pleasure to have you on. We covered a lot from China to Taipei to what is it? How do is it Taiwan, Taipei, Formosa? How do we do that?
Taiwan's the country. The Chinese won't like that, but it's Taiwan's the country. I'll just use English as it's supposed to be used. Taipei is the capital, and I refer to them as the Taiwanese. Within U.S. government circles, there's this tortured use of the English language to refer to them as the Taiwans. To me, that doesn't sound natural, so I say Taiwanese. I think there's, then a pedant or somebody who is pedantic would point out that Taiwanese actually refers to the indigenous people or something. But Taiwanese usually works. That's what I use, and that works out pretty well. Formosa is, you can use that. It's the island, and I actually do use that now and then. It's, it is helpful to make the distinction. It's not, you don't hear it a whole lot, but there's nothing wrong with using that expression either. But maybe that's because I'm 61 years old. So maybe I think it's natural, but no, it's like saying by cracky or something.
Nice. All right. Sir, first of all, thank you very much for staying up late at night and talking with us. Always appreciate you making us smarter. And travel safe, and we'll talk to you again.
Okay, thanks very much. Always enjoy it.
There you have it. That is the one and only Grant Newsham here on All Marine Radio. It's interesting the email you get with different guests. And Grant is a favorite because of, we don't hear that kind of expertise often. And so it's somewhat novel. Somebody sent me an email and said, I like that when the subject of Korea, China, Vietnam, the Philippines comes up, I'm the smartest person in the room because I listen to Grant. And sometimes I don't agree with him, but the discussion in the depth that he discusses them always makes me smarter, and I certainly appreciate you for having him on the show. Well, let me tell you, we appreciate him coming on. So, with that said, we will take a break. When we come back, the Gunner is going to join us here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.